Okay. So, you've got 15 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not taking any barracking. Not just yet. There are a couple of things that make a meeting go well. The first is the catering. The second is the parking. The third, and probably most importantly, is the networking. People rarely ever pass comment on the educational or quality of the speakers. It's fantastic to see all of this networking going on. And I feel slightly guilty about stopping it, but I've stopped it. You'll have seen the agenda for the second part of the morning. A couple of bits of housekeeping. For the medics here who want to get CPD, there's a certificate here that Gwen at the front is very happy to fill in at a very reasonable cost. And Catherine's asked me just to mention that the Scottish Government have set an ambitious target of recruiting 11,000 people to help childcare. The Scottish Government will be having a marketing campaign alerting people, the public, to this job opportunity. Just for you to be aware that the government is in investing in early learning and childcare, and there will be an expansion, as I say, to 11,000 people over the near future. So that was the second thing. So I've been given blow-by-blow accounts of what to do today. It's great. I can't possibly go wrong as long as I read from this. The next session is going to be kicked off with a five-minute introduction from my colleague Una McFadden from Forth Valley. And then we have five 10-minute talks. And a bit of mental arithmetic tells me that gives us 55 minutes. So at 5 to 12, the final talk will finish, and then we will have some questions that will arise. The theme that's running through this next 55-minute talks is equality. How do we give all of our children the same? Not quite an easy topic, but we don't go there because it's easy. We go there because it's hard. Now then, I'm desperately looking for Una, who was sat there. It's behind you. It's pantomime season. Okay, Una, thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning, everyone. I've got 5 minutes, so I'm going to talk fast. In 2010, I spoke at the Action for Sick Children Scotland conference to raise the need for babies to be seen as children and to have the same rights under the UN Convention, and the each charter to not be separated from their parents and not to be kept in hospital if their care could be out of hospital. And I have huge credit to give to Dr. Calderwood and the Scottish Government for now bringing forward the report on the review of maternity and neonatal services from Jane Grant, which says that we should be aiming in the next 5 years to have family-centred care, to have babies kept with their families in hospital as well as out of hospital, and to have transitional care keep babies in hospital for the least possible length of time. So I am delighted that that challenge has been taken up and hopefully will be taken forward. And then in 2014, the Action for Sick Children Scotland conference challenged all the delegates there to go back to their place of work and ask children what really mattered to them. And I think that that too has been taken forward, and we have many better child-centred and family-centred facilities in hospitals, as Richard was pointing out this morning. So you might think Action for Sick Children Scotland has achieved its aims. Why do we need it anymore? And as Richard said, we didn't. So we're now Children's Health Scotland instead. And that's emphasising the need for all of us to keep on improving and to look to take up the challenge for change. And what I would ask all of you today to think about as a challenge is to think about every single child and think about where children's health could be impacted by what you do and what the people around you do and what we don't do. And just think about the number of healthcare facilities and education facilities even where it isn't designed for children, even though children are the people who matter most in that setting. How many of you with GP practices have a child-sized toilet or a child-height wash basin? Tesco manage it, Asda manage it, but we don't do it in children's services. How do we get children to wash their hands when they can't reach the wash basin? And yet that's healthcare for children. So all of us, every one of us, can do something to highlight the importance of children as children, and not to say this group deserves something special because they have a label, because they have something that we think is important, because that implies that we don't think all the other children are important. And just yesterday, a mum asked me, why do some young people have services up to the age of 24 when my 22-year-old gets nothing? And I had to say, it's because the Teenage Cancer Trust funds children, young people who have cancer, but that excludes all the children and young people who don't have cancer. So if one set of children and young people need a service and benefit from it, our job is to think, what can we do for all the rest? And that's really the theme of the next session. So I welcome all our expert speakers. I think I've kept my 5 minutes, and I hope the session goes well. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to come along and talk today. It's not often you get GPs who talk to people outside of general practice about being a GP. I'm a GP in Govan. My name's Anne Mullen. Govan's one of the 100 most deprived practices in Scotland, so I chair GPs at the Deep End, and we address, lobby, write about what it's like to work in deprived practices. Child health is obviously quite a big part of that agenda, and I'm going to talk about a little bit about the SHIP project that I'm involved in, and a little bit about the progress of child welfare issues and how that impacts in general practice. I've got 26 slides, so someone's going to tell me when it's 5 minutes, so I don't overrun. some of the slides I'll just skim over because hopefully they'll get on the website at some point. This is a writer. If you want to look about health inequality and how it impacts on people's lives in the long term, the short term, where it sits in the political agenda. This is a very good writer, Danny Darling. You may have heard of him. He's written quite a famous book called Inequality in 1%. And basically, he's telling us really what we've known for a long time, that the income and wealth gaps in the country is not good for people's health. Their social circumstances, if they're living in poverty, is not good, and it affects people across the life course. And worryingly, in the country, with the austerity agenda, the inequality gap is getting bigger. This is a slide of, obviously, Glasgow. The ScotPol website is actually a very good website if you love stats. And really the thing that is of interest here is there's not a huge amount of data on about children that we can use in general practice, but we have great rates for immunisation in Govan, which is a deprived area, compared to White Craigs, which is a very affluent area. So we're doing lots of really good things in the early years, but not so good as you become older. Your life expectancy reduces in Govan. You're more likely to go into hospital. You're more likely to have COPD and all the things that are well known about and well documented. And I just want to say very quickly what general practice's role is in child health, because I think the profession itself kind of struggles to understand what it's actually doing in child health, because we're generalists, we're not a specialist service. It's easier to understand specialist services because they have mission statements about what their specialism is and where the thresholds are of intervention or referral. And general practice is really the messy end of health. Everything, we are the gatekeepers of the NHS, but there isn't a gate. People just walk through. And for children and families, I think the parenting, supporting that, the safeguarding, managing sick children, mental health, prescribing are actually really, really important for general practice out of all the things that the RCGP talked about. And we really want to get the message out that general practice provides continuous coverage over the life course. You know, when we're talking about children's health and inequalities, you're really talking a lot about parental health, parental economic inequalities, the environment people are living in. So all of that comes into the mix when you're trying to address child health inequalities in general practice. Because often the clinical encounter is through the parental issues. Children, although we know they're linguistically competent by the age of five and can account for themselves in that respect, we don't design services to speak to children in that way and find out what's wrong with them. But there are enduring challenges out with really the control of health and general practice, and that's really to do with income, wealth, and power. And I think, as we're seeing in these very difficult times, if the inequality gap is increasing, power is concentrated, wealth is concentrated, the state services, the state infrastructure suffers. And children poverty, a very long-term and enduring issue that we seem to still struggle with, and of course we're going back the way, I think, in terms of numbers. So it's very pleasing when the Scottish Government published their poverty strategy a couple of days ago. But it's taking a long time. And why is that? We're wall-to-wall with legislation about inequalities, child health, policy directives, strategies, initiatives, and yet we're still struggling. We still have huge numbers of impoverished children. We still struggle, I think, with the concept of inequality. What does it actually mean to people? It's a big, broad term. It means different things to different people. Is it access to services? Is it just being the unworried, unwell in general practice? Particularly in area of deprivation, people don't consult if they're the unworried, unwell. How does that affect children? So there's a very interesting document that's been published for the four nations in the UK, and there are specific recommendations for Scotland. And I think, again, the ones that I've highlighted in red are the ones I think the project in Govan is particularly interested in. We are particularly interested in having our own database. General practice doesn't write things down very much, so we can't tell people what we do in any sort of formalised sense. We're relying on ISD for stats, but actually developing a localised database is actually really important to reflect the complexity of our localised communities. We want to maximise women's health during pregnancy and before and after. I think there is a problem with the way services are set up. You know, the maternity service, when it was changed, and I think it's a good change, but general practice was really chopped out of that discussion. So when it initially started up, when women were going to just midwife-led care, and we weren't really involved anymore. And we struggled with that because we felt the communication link was broken. So I think whenever there are big policy changes where general practice has been involved, I think it's a really good idea to have a general practice impact assessment statement, anticipating what the issues might be for general practice. And we also want to maximise mental health and wellbeing. That's a big plank of what we do, particularly in deprived practices. Mental health is the biggest comorbidity that we see. And you'll all be familiar with probably the issue about early mortality, end of early healthy living, 10 or 15 years earlier in places like Govan, where I work. And that is something we're seeking to address. But we have a problem because general practice is less involved in preventative health care since the Hall 4 report came out in 2005, I think. We used to do a lot of unscheduled child health assessments through screening, which weren't really that useful in terms of picking up clicky hips or heart murmurs. But actually what that gave us was a platform to engage with parents and see them and develop that relationship. In general practice, I think dealing with complex families is all about developing that relationship over the long term, but the trusted relationship. The only way people that are vulnerable will come and speak to you is if they know you and they trust you. So that was a problem for us. And this is quite an interesting graph that Phil Wilson published with Rachel Woods, I think, about the decline in preventative health care, which obviously, again, was a knock-on effect that wasn't anticipated. And expenditure in the NHS and primary care is also an issue in general practice, which we hope will be addressed. But there are structural issues, professional behaviours, parental behaviours, that keep us from seeing what's actually underneath the tip of the iceberg with vulnerable children and families. And that's some of the issues that come out. So hostile parents, professionals just overwhelmed with caseloads, and that leads to the inverse care law in health and inverse intervention law in social work, or start again syndrome, where we just think that things are going to get better and we'll just not deal with it because our caseload is too big, we don't have enough time, etc. And there's also an ideological issue where I think throughout the history of child welfare, children have either been seen as victims or threats, and that's still quite relevant today. You can have a look at some of these headlines. And this was a quote from a doctor examining children for a school board. Clearly not concerned that they were starving and exhausted. He was just concerned that they would all turn into criminals. And we still reproduce that language, that ideology in some way. And I think that's important to recognize that children in this country are still very marginalized by adults and adult policies. So in Govan, we decided to do something quite different. This is Kintra Street in Govan. When I joined the practice, it looked like this. This is another film called Ratcatcher, and Lynn Ramsey chose the street because it just looked so awful. And this is Kintra Street now. They've flattened it and rebuilt it. So if you really want to help with child health inequality, you do something like that. You build really good sustainable housing. And the Govan Ship Project, which is, as I said, an integrated project funded by the Scottish Government, we decided we wanted to work differently. We didn't want to work like this, but we felt we were sinking all the time. We wanted to get to here. So we're in a transition phase. The project's in its third year, and we've got to do quite a lot of things that we wanted to do. We have MDT meetings where a number of us meet together and discuss complex caseloads. We've developed a database. We're engaging with patients. We're disseminating the learning from it. We're trying to fit the learning from Govan into the bigger pictures of strategies and research and what's known already. And we're trying to normalise the work. But it's not a straight line, so you have setbacks and you just change direction when things aren't going quite the way you thought it would go. That's the kind of structure of an MDT meeting where, obviously, with the children and family section of the MDT meeting, we would discuss with health visitors, probably links worker, maybe someone from housing, plan what we would do in terms of service provision. And I just want to say about numbers. There are 15 children in the Southwest that's out with you in our health centre. The whole Southwest, there are 15 children on the Child Protection Register. And that's the numbers that we've talked about in the project. So you can see we're beginning to look under the tip of that iceberg that I showed you. And we have developed our own database, which was one of the recommendations of Climbie. So it's taken 14 years for that to happen, I think. We would develop much more than just discussing, we want to know what schools are at, we want to know about parental health, and we pull it all into the children's records. I'm just going to flick through this slide. But that's ACES, which is a very important study. But ACES has to fit in with what's already known at the moment, what's already been done on the ground. We can't suddenly import the findings from ACES and just put it into a Scottish context and destabilise the services that we have. Resilience is a very important concept if you talk about vulnerability. And if you want to read what we were doing with extra time, which is a real finding stone of the project, the DPEN project, so the DPEN Report 29 sort of outlines some of the cases that we dealt with and why we needed the extra time. And it's just detailing the complexity of the families that they deal with. But there's still a big challenge to the project to scale up because we think the generic elements of it should be scaled up across Scotland. So we get to build strong patient narratives based on the knowledge and confidence in managing the problems that we need to move forward. And we get to where we want to go, which is integrated care.
Anne, thank you very much. So next, whilst Evelyn comes up, I mean, we've got five people who approach child health from different aspects, but I think there will be very common themes that come throughout. Thank you very much, Evelyn.
Hi, I'm Evelyn Roger. I'm one of three Diana Children's Nurses who works for CHAS, Children's Hospice across Scotland, and I'm here today to talk about equality for end-of-life care for neonates. I'd just like to say I have some family photos that are in my presentation, which the families have given me permission to share, but not for tweeting or Facebook, please. Thank you. So neonatal palliative care is an evolving speciality, and good quality care improves the care for the baby, improves the experience for the families, and also improves bereavement care for afterwards, and it improves the experience for staff who get the experience of feeling that they've done the best that they can. So there are 15 neonatal units in Scotland, and eight of these provide intensive care. And this is a typical bed space in intensive care. So if this is the first time you're being introduced to your baby, you can imagine that's quite a scary first meeting. We were really pleased when the first national framework to include children was published by the Scottish Government in 2015. And personally, to see that the age group started at zero was a big thing for me, because it meant that the ladies that I support antenatally who continue with pregnancy were recognised that the babies also needed to receive this care before they were born. The perinatal framework that's currently being piloted in Lothian also recognises this, and there is a huge focus for us on earlier identification of these babies, and especially in the antenatal period, where we can introduce anticipatory care planning with the families to give them a sense of control back, planning their birth, planning their labour and delivery, and how much intervention happens once that baby is born. We also highlight to the families the choices that are available to them and take on board their wishing, and also to try and include the family and siblings more in that as well. And it also, the care goals, there are 9 care goals in this framework, and the last one is care during and after death as well. CHAS funded a piece of research which was published in 2015 with York University to find out how many children in Scotland were actually living with palliative care needs. And they found that there was over 15,000, nearly 15,500 children, and nearly 5,000 of these children were under 5 years old. But you'll see from this graph here that children under 1 were the highest age group of deaths. And that children, one of the recommendations of the report were that children under 1 year of age should be seen as a priority group from input for palliative care services. So the new CHAS plan, currently CHAS are only seeing 1 in 3 of these children. So our new CHAS plan aims to reach more of these children. And to do this, we need the help of our colleagues. So we undertook a project where we started working alongside our NHS colleagues. I was employed by CHAS in June 2014, and before taking up that post, I worked in Simpson's neonatal unit as a staff nurse there. So we introduced a member of the family support team from CHAS to come into the unit and work 1 day a week in the unit. And at the introduction of this, we thought it would be to introduce memory making at an earlier stage. We also employed a joint consultant to work jointly within the NHS and CHAS, and open the families who need this service to the wider access of the wider CHAS team. And we work collaboratively alongside our NHS colleagues who deliver excellent care every day. The key learning from our project working within the NHS, we did do memory making, but actually the nurses took this on board really quickly and learned to do that fantastically themselves too. But we showed them how to do enhanced memory making, including siblings in that. Including siblings in an intensive care area can be quite challenging. The biggest area, which was quite surprising for us, was the amount of families that took up the emotional support that was offered by our family support team. And that included getting advice on financial aspects for travelling. We introduced memory making before death, because traditionally it had been something that was done after the baby had died. And although this is a major challenge in an intensive care unit, with careful planning and family involvement, you can see here what can be achieved. Involving siblings in an intensive care area is sometimes quite a scary thought, but kids are amazing and they actually accept it, and it's sometimes our own beliefs about what is right and wrong for them that is proved wrong. And you can see here this ventilated baby with all her tubes and attachments. It didn't bother her 7-year-old sister who just wanted to do hand painting with her. We're also introducing choice. Choice of place of death is something that we didn't really think about. And most of those children under one who die in hospital. By offering choice, we're working alongside our NHS colleagues. Taking a baby home to die involves working closely with the GP and community practices, and also transferring babies to the hospice for end-of-life care involves joint working with our palliative care colleagues. Post-death care as well. Traditionally, once parents had left the unit after their baby died, most neonatal staff would never see that family again. I have the privilege of continuing that link and often visiting these families at home for many months after their baby has died. Collaborative working together with our NHS colleagues has highlighted that it's possible to get these babies home after they've died if it's not possible beforehand, and that involves good communication and collaborative working. And that empowers parents to be parents, the ability to actually parent their child after death, which they've often not been allowed to do in an intensive care area because it's just not been possible. And memory making is so important to these families. When I go and visit them at home, their child is a very visible presence. They continue the memory making that we've started off with them in hospital and can often go on to make fantastic displays. So what we need to establish a level playing field is training of specialist nursing and medical staff, dedicated time for palliative care, resources, and a national anticipatory care plan. And I'd just like to finish off by reading a quote from one of the parents who lost their child, and it's the most devastating experience for anybody, but actually they look at it in quite a positive way. Thursday was the best and worst day of our lives. We finally got to hold our son without all his wires and tubes. We got to paint his feet and hands and make lovely canvases of his hands and feet, making lovely memories, to bath and dress him in his own clothes the day he died.
I think it's Frank who's coming. There's a blank name in the programme, but by a process of elimination, I've seen Frank's name. So, Evelyn, thank you very much. There's already a theme emerging this morning. I'm interested to see if it's going to carry on. So, Frank, thank you very much for coming to talk about disabled children.
Thank you. And for one day only, I'll be stepping in for Jan Savage, who sends her apologies that she's not been able to join us this morning. But I work in policy and research for Enable Scotland, so I've come along in Jan's place. Enable's a charitable organisation that was founded back in 1954 by the parents of children who had learning disabilities. The objective being to ensure that people who have learning disabilities have the same choices and opportunities in life as everyone else. And to this day, a large part of our 5,000-strong membership are parents and carers of children and young people who have learning disabilities. So we frequently hear first-hand accounts of the challenges faced accessing health services and maintaining good health. Now, an estimated 120,000 people in Scotland have a learning disability. That's including over 15,000 school-aged children and young people identified as having an additional support need resultant from a learning disability. The diagnosis of a learning disability can often be the key that unlocks access to vital support and services for children and their families. However, the journey to receiving that diagnosis is often long, torturous, and complex, with multiple referrals. And parents tell us they are provided with little or no targeted information and advice on benefits or social work support, meaning families are often struggling without any support during the formative years of their disabled child's life. Research that Enable Scotland commissioned with the support of the Scottish Government and the Big Lottery Fund in 2015 found that the mean period for a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder was 36 months. And for global development delay, it was 25 months. Parents often tell us they have to fight for everything their disabled child receives. A significant additional source of stress for families already dealing with the challenges that come with raising a child who has a learning disability. Lack of access to information, support, and advocacy services can mean that some parents who are not as confident or as forceful as others may not be able to secure all the support that their child needs. There's a further challenge for parents to balance the what the child can do approach of the education system, and which many prefer, against the need to focus on what the child cannot do in order to access welfare benefits and social work support, a negative approach to their child which many families tell us they find traumatic. Now, people who have learning disabilities face many health inequalities and consequently have some of the poorest health of any group in Scotland. People with a learning disability have more healthcare needs than the general population, yet they may use health services less. There are higher rates of epilepsy, visual and hearing impairments, psychiatric illness, tooth decay, and obesity in people with learning disability compared to the general population. In fact, young people aged 16 to 24 who have learning disabilities experience higher rates of obesity than adults over 50 who do not have learning disabilities. Part of this problem is the sedentary lifestyle that many young people with a learning disability have. In fact, children and young people with a learning disability spend on average 85% of each day sitting or lying down. It is also sadly the case that people who have learning disabilities are more likely to experience physical or sexual abuse and are more likely to be victims of crime. Indeed, they're considerably more likely to die at an early age than the general population. This was found to be on average 20 years before the general population. Now, inequality is already evident in childhood. Research by the Scottish Learning Disabilities Observatory found that 15% of under 16s with a learning disability describe their own health as bad or very bad. That's 15%. For the population of all under 16s, that was 0.4%. 42% of under 16s with a learning disability describe their health as good or very good. That's 88% of all under 16s. Now, people who have learning disabilities are less likely to exercise and eat healthily than the general public because they may not always have the knowledge or understanding to make healthy choices and are reliant on others for support and communication. Addressing these issues at an early age is vital to improving health in adulthood. Yet these challenges are often exacerbated by problems accessing the health services they need. Indeed, people who have learning disabilities often struggle to access health services that are tailored to their needs, because there's a lack of expertise in the primary care sector. And our members tell us that primary and acute healthcare settings often fail to make reasonable adjustments under the terms of the Equality Act for patients who have a learning disability. We've also gathered evidence of diagnostic overshadowing. That is the tendency of clinicians to overlook symptoms of mental and physical health problems in patients with learning disabilities, attributing them to being part of having a learning disability. Enable Scotland recently ran a project with Macmillan working with cancer patients who had learning disabilities, and we found that one third of them had received a late diagnosis. This is a significantly high percentage, and it always had a negative impact on the pathway or outcome for that individual. We have heard similar anecdotal examples of diagnostic overshadowing when children and young people who have learning disabilities present with symptoms of illness which are not correctly diagnosed in the first instance, which can cause prolonged suffering and potentially see those conditions develop into something more serious. Now, it's impossible to overlook the direct link that exists between disability and poverty and poor health. In Scotland, almost one in five families with disabled children are missing meals, and 18% of families cannot afford to heat their homes. Almost 90% of families who have with children with a learning disability told Enable Scotland that this was having an impact on their family finances. 58% of families with disabled children fear their financial situation will worsen in the next year, mostly due to the welfare reforms which are being rolled out and are hitting households with disabled adults and children hardest. There are various other issues that impact upon the health and well-being of children and young people who have learning disabilities. Most children who have a learning disability in Scotland today will be educated in a mainstream environment, which is something that we welcome wherever it's possible. However, children still report feeling lonely, excluded from the classroom and the curriculum, and parents report having to constantly fight for their children's right to be included. Our recent Included in the Main campaign found that more than half of children and young people who have learning disabilities feel they are not getting the right support at school, and only 20% of their families feel the support provided to their child is enough to facilitate their participation in all parts of the school's life. In fact, 2/3 believe it is not good enough. 60% of young people who have a learning disability told Enable Scotland they feel lonely at school. 16% said they don't have any friends. 39% don't see friends outside of school. And more than a quarter of young people who have learning disabilities told us they can't take part in games and sports with other children at school. The isolation and exclusion from activity in childhood can lay the foundations for health problems into adulthood. It gets no easier when a young person leaves school. In 2013, only 7.3% of adults who have a learning disability were in employment. Now, employment rates vary considerably by impairment, and people with depression and learning disabilities were the least likely to be in employment. Now, progress has certainly been made in addressing these health inequalities in recent years. That's been helped in a large part by the recommendations of the Scottish Government's Keys to Life programme. But there's undoubtedly still a long way to go. The establishment of the Scottish Learning Disabilities Observatory has played a big part in increasing the visibility of these issues by providing statistical evidence of the scale of the issues that people with learning disabilities face. But there's a clear need for more training about clear referral pathways for the learning disability diagnosis, for a toolkit to support health professionals and social work when they are engaging with the families of children who have learning disabilities. And I'll finish with a frustration that many of our members bring to us, is that when they do go to a GP surgery or access health services, they feel like they're not being understood. They feel like they're not being listened to, that the health professionals they're dealing with don't understand what their issue is and the support that they need. So there's a clear need for us to ensure that there's a better way of communicating and understanding when people with learning disabilities present themselves to health services. And hopefully we can explore more of the solutions in the discussion later. Thank you.
Frank Thurrock, thank you very much. 9 minutes, 53 seconds. Thank you very much. And next, Anne is already here to talk about refugees and asylum seekers. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you very much for inviting me along. Just to give you a whistle stop tour of the issues for asylum seekers and refugee and children in Scotland. Hopefully just in that is to give a bit of context about kind of the world events and what's happening, and thinking about how NHS Scotland have supported us to respond, give a wee bit of context about the Glasgow perspective as a dispersal site for asylum seekers in the UK, and a wee bit of reflection hopefully from yourselves in terms of how we respond to the needs of asylum seekers and refugees. That's the context in Scotland that Glasgow has been the main dispersal site from the Home Office where they will route people for support. However, since kind of 2015, that has changed in terms of the Syrian resettlement scheme, where 29 local authorities in Scotland have welcomed refugees into their communities. So that there is certainly much more of a Scottish context since that initiative took place, which will continue over. It's got 3 years to go. So I always use every opportunity to do a bit of kind of myth-busting and facts around what the world context is. I was having a look for the most up-to-date figures around the proportion of displaced people in the world that are being welcomed into the UK, and haven't found a more up-to-date statistic than the kind of 2014 statistic in that it's 0.24% of the displaced population in the world that are in the UK, although our media would like to tell a different story about the kind of use of resources that are being used in the UK. So kind of some kind of facts up there are around just kind of over 65 million people are displaced kind of worldwide. So that's bigger than kind of World War II. And that most of the people are displaced internally, so they don't actually leave their country. And the people who welcome most displaced people in another country are in the developing world. But over half of that 65 million are children. And there's the kind of unaccompanied, so people who children who have not been accompanied. The kind of UNHCR figures are around 75,000. And in the UK, what that means is that there is roughly 36,500 asylum applications in process. One in five are dependents. From that, the asylum process, roughly 30% will receive leave to remain, and kind of over the kind of first application. So not everybody is entitled to stay. And once people get leave to remain, that's not indefinite leave to remain. The longest you will get in the UK is 5 years. So at every point, there is always kind of uncertainty in family life about where to settle. And currently in the UK, and kind of the midsummer statistics, is there's roughly 3,500 unaccompanied children being supported in the UK. That might become more relevant. Normally, the children are supported closest to their port of entry, which tends to be down south, but there is a Home Office are looking at widening dispersal and are approaching all local authority areas in the UK and looking at proportionate distribution, because it's having significant impact on resources in local authority areas in the south of England. So asylum seekers and refugees, I think it's important to remember that they're ordinary people, ordinary children in extraordinary circumstances, and they are vulnerable, but they are extremely resilient and skilled and resourceful. So kind of some of the challenges for me in terms of being operationally responsible for NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde and Glasgow City's healthcare responses is probably recognising our response to the enormity of world events and trying to comprehend the suffering and the torture that is going on, and about what one human person can do to another, and how we support our staff to listen to these stories day in, day out. And some of that's no different from the other parts of the business that we work in and we've heard about today in terms of kind of childhood adverse events. But the kind of challenge as well for us is around providing kind of safety for individuals who are going through a really cruel process in terms of the asylum process. And I'm saying a cruel process, but it is based on immigration law, and that's the law that people will be assessed under. But we do recognise the re-traumatising that are happening to adults, children, and families as they go through the process for a decision to be made if they're right to remain in the country. Providing culturally sensitive healthcare across a whole system that reduces isolation and kind of social exclusion, which ultimately result in poor health. Currently, kind of in Glasgow, we support around 4,000 asylum seekers at any one time. We don't have the figures around refugees, and there's a bit of debate about that, about how we then meet their needs. But once you become a refugee, you have the same rights and entitlements as everybody else, so therefore should we be monitoring people in a different way? So think around rights and entitlements and how we've been able to kind of step up to the challenges. In Scotland, we are very fortunate that Scottish Government made the decision a number of years ago that every asylum seeker or refugee has full rights and entitlement to healthcare, and that really makes my job easy. Although we still have some kind of practice around the healthcare system and about asking people to provide identification about their status. That is not a requirement. So regardless of your stage in the process, and if you're a failed asylum seeker, you still have full rights and entitlement to healthcare. And I think a lot of our information comes again from the media, where the situation is different in NHS England. So there's a key message in there that if somebody's in the asylum process, then we still provide full rights and entitlement. So in Glasgow, again, that's further made easy in terms of the kind of national rights and entitlement agenda to healthcare is about how we treat people fairly and embedded in our kind of equality policies about meeting the needs of marginalised groups and moving discrimination across the healthcare system to enable the stuff that makes all of us kind of feel welcomed, important and listened to, and we've heard some of that this morning, and we should be thinking about tailoring our response to individuals. So more operationally, what we have in Glasgow is the Asylum Health Bridging Team. So when individuals or families and children are routed by the Home Office up to Glasgow to be provided with accommodation, then we will be notified and we will offer an initial health screening to all newly arrived asylum seekers living in initial accommodation. And then the focus and our overall aim is to access universal health care, and that's done through GP registration. But while children are living in initial accommodation, which can be shared accommodation, then we will at that point make registration with a GP so that they then have immediate access to universal health care, immunisation, health visitors. And a lot of kind of initiatives are on out in the community through our kind of health improvement works and working with connections through our integration networks run by our charitable organisations and around building capacity in the system, not in terms of specialist services. So there is an ongoing debate around kind of whether for marginalised groups we should deliver specialist services or we should deliver services through mainstream. And I would always challenge that in terms of reducing the inequality gap. Then in terms of universal healthcare, we all need to get better about how we welcome and respond to the different needs of individuals in our population. So key aims for us is about that access to universal health care, and we have a nurse-led team that deliver the assessments and link people into services. So some of the kind of health issues and challenges is about that, and thinking about if people, asylum seekers or refugees are coming into your area, is about key messages about introducing people to the NHS that come from very different healthcare systems, about our consultant times working with interpreters and the skill in doing that, how we understand communities and reduce isolation for people, and we'd use some kind of peer education and working with people with lived experience. And a big challenge for us is around our health behaviours and people becoming very westernised very quickly. So most kind of children and adults are fairly healthy individuals, not in terms of kind of some of the health issues that we would see in Scotland, but living in our communities, and they tend to all to be accommodated in areas of high deprivation, then that becomes an issue. So there's just some things here, kind of quick reminders around good practice, and I suppose the kind of key message in there is don't assume that what you do is always best, and always ask. Individuals coming from different cultures welcome that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Awkward time of day. It's still good morning. for another 6 minutes. Thank you very much.
Well, for the next 6 minutes, good morning, everyone. I'm not going to do a PowerPoint. I'm just going to tell you a story. But unfortunately, I come from a public health background, and having spent well over a decade with NHS Éireann Éireann as Child Health Commissioner, I can't give you information without giving you the evidence base. So at the back of the room on the table, there's a brochure that will outline everything I'm saying, give you some more detail on what I'm about to talk about. What I was asked to do is look at equal access to the best possible healthcare services and relate that to children in care. Now, my great temptation was to put a no 10 foot high up in this board and just let you all have a conversation about it, because kids in care are not in any way, shape or form getting equal access to healthcare. I'm going to give you some basic information, then I'm going to go into a story about a young man called Connor, who had a conversation with a couple of weeks ago and got his permission to tell you a little bit about him and his story. The profile for the young people that we deal with in the main campus is that the boys have been known to social work or social care since they were about 6 years old. Girls had been known to the services, sort of everybody in this room and services relate to, since they were about seven. They arrive with us about 14 and a half. They have spent 8 years by that time in care. They have faced up to 27 separate placements. So unless you're an army brat or something like that, and you've been taken about by mum and dad, you know, around the world, have a think about how many times when you were a child you moved house. Then have a think about how many times you could cope with being taken away from your parent. And then tell me that these kids are not traumatised. 27 placements in 8 years, and that's normal for the young people that we are dealing with. The opportunity to intervene early is clearly there. We're changing our services to make sure we're much closer to early intervention. We're developing services for five-year-olds and up, and we're literally working with the brothers and sisters of the older kids in the main campus. What we have is a real question for you. How many chances do we as corporate parents need to get this right for these young people? And they're challenging young people. This isn't easy. This isn't a wee switch that we can turn around and say, this is how we fix you. There's a number of issues in here, but we need to try and work better together to get better information to take that forward. We have health needs assessments. It's improved. 30 years ago when I started, all we had to do was get the NIT nurse in and make sure they didn't have NITs and they weren't infectious. If they couldn't give a bug to everybody else in the unit, then he'd get in. Nowadays, we have health needs assessments. And 3 years ago, when I arrived in Kibble, having left the NHS, I did a screen, and we have approaching 160 young people with us in various bits and pieces, 100 in care. 3 years ago, I couldn't find a health needs assessment for any of those young people. I went to a couple of local authorities and said, what's happening? Where are they? Well, I know they're getting done. I worked in the NHS Éireann Éireann with the LAC team. We know we do them. So where are they going? Spoke to a couple of chief social workers and said, where are they? I said, we're doing them. These health needs assessments are happening. Health needs assessments went to the social worker, and the social workers decided that it wasn't appropriate to share them with the residential care workers. They didn't think that was helpful. Today, if we get them, and we don't get them for all of our young people, for males, 45% of the health needs assessments are incomplete. For females, 27% of the health needs assessment are incomplete. There's no consistency and no standard format. We have really good relationships across the board with people, and we can get those gaps filled. But it takes a huge amount of work, and it's 6 weeks after they arrive in care, on average, that we've managed to complete and close that circle. That's 6 weeks the young people have been in care without us knowing exactly how to approach this. If you've got a cognitive delay, there's a different approach. If you've got fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, there's a different approach to take with that. And we need to know that from the outset. What's meant to happen in the system is before the young person arrives, we have a health needs assessment, and we develop services and build services round about then. And we can't do that in the current system. Are they fit for purpose? In part. The information that contained in them is relevant and is helpful, and we really do get some really good examples of them coming through. There are good practices out there, but are they good enough? I don't think so. I really don't think so. So I went along to see one of our young people, Connor, who is has given me full permission to talk to you. And if you knew Connor, that's a hell of a victory. He is not the easiest young person in the world. If you look at ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, Connor would score an 8. So he's extremely traumatised. We know his cognitive delay. We know he has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and somewhere in there. We know there's a communication delay. We know he comes from an area of deprivation, poverty. As a result of that, in the past 3 years, he's had 80 restraints. Now, that varies from somebody holding his arm and walking him out of the room to four of my guys actually having to hold him down because he's trying to knife somebody. It goes across the board. This is an extremely challenging young person. Love him dearly. He's a great kid when he's fine. When he's not fine, I like being somebody else being in the room at the same time. There's 18 assaults on staff in that three-year period, and that's serious assaults, and what I mean by is that staff had required medical treatment at the end of that. There was 3 terms in secure care, and that's a heck of a thing to do to any young person. It's something we want to avoid across the board. And in all of that, there's a dozen or more lack reviews. Again, the opportunity is there to intervene better. Mum has significant mental health issues. If you look at the brochure I've left at the back, kind of thing, you'll see in secure care, for example, 60% of mums who have children in secure care have significant mental health problems. The big thing I would like to get into, but not in 10 minutes, is the connection between parental health and how that impacts on the child needs to be resolved. This cannot just be a focus on the child. The child is part of a family unit, a family structure, and we need to be looking at the family as a whole. You do not get healthy parents unless you get healthy children. You don't get healthy children unless you get healthy parents. And it needs to be a joint effort across the board to take that forward. Now, forgive me, Catherine. I took Connor and a bunch of kids to the chip shop. probably not the best thing to tell this audience. They only go once a week, genuinely, kind of thing. But I went along, and I'm a bit weird because I'm a vegetarian, can't eat at the chip shop. So all the kids think I'm odd anyway. I'm the guy that arrives in the suit. And Connor ordered what he always ordered, which is a sausage supper. Always gets the same thing. So they didn't want to go back to the units. We're all sitting in the park on different walls and things, and I'm sitting next to Connor having a chat with him and said, why do you always get the same thing? He's like, why don't you get something else? Didn't answer. Left it. It wasn't that important a question kind of thing, but went back to it 10 minutes later, bursting into tears. What have I done? I'm trying to think through my brain what I've just said and whether I've said something that's really going to trigger him and where we're going to go from there. I can't read. What do you mean you can't read? This kid's 14 and a half. No, I can't read. I can't see the menu. I don't know what it is. I don't know what else to order. And I'm like, that's really weird. Kind of thing. Surely, given he's been in this system for 8 years, somebody would have noticed that he can't read or what's happening with him. Sat him down again, kind of thing, left it for a day, went back in to revisit it, kind of thing, and quite clearly his literacy standard was probably equivalent to a 5-6-year-old, kind of thing. He had some literacy, but not very much at all. The other thing that was bothering me, though, is when you go into the chip shop with Paisley, again, forgive me, Catherine, there's pictures of all the different things you can get, and obviously in front of you is a bigger choice. I'm not getting this, I just couldn't get it, and I thought, well, has he had his eyes tested? So I went back through, the director didn't do that. I got somebody else to go back through the records and check, kind of thing. And we looked, and three attempts had been made to take him to an optician over the years, none of which had been successful. I said, look, get him to the optician, get him to examine, have a look at this and see what's going to go on. So I got a phone call a few days later, kind of thing, to say, Jim, you're going to have to come down. Okay, what's happened? He attacked the optician. I went, all right, okay. Who am I apologising to now? went down to see them. Said, right, okay, what's happened? I went to talk to Connor. He wouldn't talk to anybody. We could not get through to him at all. A few days later, Connor has decided he wants to go back to the optician. So he goes back to the optician and passes it straight across the board. reads off the chart, just no hassle at all. This does not make sense. What else is round? So we're trying everything we can to try and work this out, and nothing was happening. 2 weeks ago, I was going to see Connor to ask his permission to talk to you guys about his case and tell you what he was doing. And I said, what happened? You know, what's going on? He said, I'm not wearing glasses. I don't care what you're telling me. I am not wearing glasses. I said, but you've just passed your opticians. You know what it is. No, I faked it. I said, how did you fake it? The first time he went, he took his phone, photographed the bloody eye chart, decided I have to get out of here because I'm going to have to remember this, goes back to the unit, memorises the entire eye chart, then asks to go back to the optician and passes the test. And I'm going, you show me your phone, give me your bloody phone. So what have you done? Found his phone, picture the eye chart, all memorised, and I went, right, give me that there. Tell me what's in that eye chart. Straight off the top of his head, all the way through, got it completely. And this is a kid who's really traumatic. Well, then had a conversation about why he doesn't go to school, because he feels like a complete blooming idiot. He can't see the board. He can't see what's in front of him. He's short-sighted. He could not see what was going on. The big solution in my genius brain, because he doesn't want to wear glasses, I'll buy you contact lenses. You want to get contact lenses? Can't afford them. Went, what do you mean you can't afford them? I said, well, you get glasses for free, you don't get contact lenses for free. He'd worked all this out. He knew what he was doing. He knew what he was talking about and where he was going from there. So you've got a kid who scores 8 in the ACES scale, horrendous history, and he managed to go through a care system for 8 years with nobody actually working out. Everybody suspected it was there, but nobody actually working out. This kid cannot see. And he was finding umpteen coping strategies to deal with this. And we were wondering what was happening. So you start to go back through the records, and you're thinking, this kid's really pissing off the teachers. Why is he pissing off the teachers? He was sitting in the front of the class, dropping everything. And teachers thought, he's just been irritating, he's just trying to get to us. He drops things in front of him so he can get closer to the board and then see what's there, then come back to his desk and sit down and write it down. These kids are not dumb. They're not stupid. They're extremely able. And if you're going to survive what they have been through, they have great coping strategies. But genuinely, folks, we are failing to work with them together, and we're failing to identify the health needs properly of these young people. My proposal for this audience is we really need to look at standardising health needs assessment for this sector, and we really need that based on evidence, and we really need to look at what their current health needs are, not what we think we should check. Yeah. I'm quite aware we need to check for immunisations. I'm quite aware of what I need to look at and try to do that type of thing. But when you walk in a study we're in the middle of doing just now is about communication delay. And I asked a speech and language therapist to come in and talk to our kids to examine communication delay. So far, she has not found a single one of our young people who doesn't have communication delay. And she's only about a quarter of the way through the whole study. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Five talks from potentially very different perspectives. The common theme running through them is vulnerable children and young people. I've made a little list of themes that... My microphone's gone. Here we go. I'll shout at this one. I think assumptions was just made very powerfully by Jim, but that ran through quite a few of the talks about what we as a group of professionals, but also the wider society, the assumptions they have. Jim's trying to run away. No such luck. I think the other thing running through all of this is working together. Not just health, the NHS, it's about the third sector, about education. Supporting families financially, emotionally, this is another issue. And social exclusion is something else that came through. So, Una, there's a seat here for you. Did you want to... You don't get off that light. You have to earn your lunch here. So we've now got 10, 15 minutes to try and tease apart this. I guess we can perhaps finish off, start off where we finished with a challenge for us standards. But anyway, Una, you said you had a question. You ask your question, we'll take it from there.
Okay. This is partly a question, partly a story about being an examiner for the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, where I'm sure Steve sympathises. You sit with a checklist on a clipboard and tick off the things to let the candidate pass. And there's one of the stations called the communication station. And it occurred to me that we were teaching that there's just one way to be communicating correctly. And yet, probably 50% of my patients communicate differently from that. And taking Jim's point about, and Frank's, about making assumptions, I went looking then to see what we actually teach professionals about communication. And it's all about communication skills that appear to be one set of communication skills and not the ones necessarily that the person being communicated with would use. So just for information, we have a project here in the college in Edinburgh, the Adult College, looking at communication and professionals. There's a survey of professionals' awareness of their needs to learn about ways to communicate. And I think going back to our challenges, I would challenge everyone to just think about how much you know about the range of possible ways to communicate. And my question is, can we get help with doing that for the professionals and the supporters, the volunteers, everyone who has contact? So the question is to Frank and Jim. Thank you.
Not an easy question to answer right at the start there. I do think, you know, completely related to the story Jim told at the end there, I think we get told examples of situations where people with learning disabilities will sometimes try to hide conditions that they've got. They're sometimes embarrassed to admit that they're not feeling well. They're embarrassed, it's almost as if it's a failure on their part or something's wrong with them, and they try to hide that sometimes. And I think it's just really trying to bridge that gap and to find that way of being able to read those signals and understand where those communication barriers are and to break them down. It's not easy. I think what we certainly need to have is training in place to enable that to happen. We need to have as much support and expertise as possible. It's something that we've been keen on is bringing together a sort of centre of excellence on learning disability, where we can bring together the experts on these issues so that they can share that learning as widely as possible, whether it's with health professionals or education professionals or anyone that's dealing with children and young people or indeed adults with learning disabilities, that there will be that opportunity to extend that knowledge, that understanding, these communication strategies that the children and young people have. The communications passport is something that is being looked at by a number of people. It's something that we are helping out with that, to have this idea of this effectively a document which explains how a particular child likes to communicate, that this could be carried around. This could, again, be shared with health professionals, with education professionals, just to understand. And again, I think Jim's story was so powerful there, and I think that many of us will relate to examples like that. You know, if we can have a way of just sharing that information in a very straightforward, easy way that health professionals can read, this is how this particular child communicates. When they are doing this, they actually mean something else. I think that would be a very useful thing to work on, and certainly, you know, all stakeholders being involved in pulling something like that together, I think it's something that would make a big difference to a lot of lives.
Okay.
I would agree with what's been said. I think the opportunity to work with you would be more than welcome. We're more than happy to share resources and any of the sort of team we've got. For those who don't know Kibble, we're one of the oldest charities in Scotland, but also one of the biggest social enterprises in Scotland. And we have a learning development section. We have a specialist intervention section where we've got some of the best forensic psychiatrists in Scotland that work with us. And anything that helps move this forward, we'd be happy to work with you.
Okay, thank you very much. So, a flurry of hands, one at the front here, one there, and three at the back. Okay.
Hi, my name's Natalie. I'm a West Scotland paediatric trainee and a Scottish Clinical Leadership Fellow. My question's for yourself, and I recently was privileged enough to hear, now let me get his name right, Gwarly Pasarly speak about his experience as a child refugee travelling from Afghanistan to Britain, and him talking about the hope and resilience he had all the way through that experience until he actually reached the UK. And then he spoke about hopelessness and the re-trauma that you touched on during your conversation with us. To what extent are we still seeing that in the unaccompanied minors that come to Scotland and to your patch, Glasgow, and how, as health professionals, can we help alleviate that or prevent it altogether?
Okay, so I think that is just our fact. Like, and I was saying, as healthcare professionals, that's often the reality that we're faced with asylum seekers, unaccompanied minors and children, that people are on a journey for a very long time to come to somewhere that they think will be safe and for a better life. And the sad fact is that the reality kicks in, as you say. The process of asylum is documented around re-traumatisation and around children. For unaccompanied minors, then local authorities have the responsibility with kind of resources that are very stretched. I think the immigration legislation will still have a requirement currently for people to go through that painful process of demonstrating age, the torture that they're fleeing or whatever's been brought them, the persecution that's brought them to the UK. I think one of the kind of things is that there's recognising from the Home Office is that in terms of unaccompanied minors, that there is the south of England is at saturation point, and that needs to be shared across the resources. But we know that every local authority, in terms of austerity and the cuts that they've seen, they are struggling to see how that they can do that job well. So therefore, in terms of how we alleviate that, takes resources. And while that might be spread, it is in the context that local authorities are already struggling to balance their books, and they will have corporate and parent responsibility for these children while they're in care. I think one of the things that is happening around trafficking of kind of minors is that there's a national response from a psychological therapist perspective, so that if kind of children or adults are arriving at any destination throughout Scotland, then there's referral pathways into psychological therapies to help support the individuals while they're going through that process. But I don't have lots of hopefulness, but that is about, I think, every day how we welcome people when they come into contact with health services, other services, that can often make the difference, and that we trust and believe their story.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next question there, then one at the back there.
Hi, my name's Pamela Cornwallis. I'm a speech and language therapist, and I'm actually delighted to hear communication difficulties and communication disorders and the impact they can have for children and young people coming up and being discussed today. We really know it's a massive issue. We have between 10 up to 50 in some socially deprived areas percent of our children starting primary one with delayed language. They're behind game already, and the impact for them is massive. To 60% of young men in criminal justice system have speech and language difficulties, and the study you're doing might show different numbers for your own service. So really, it was just a comment to say it's great to hear it highlighted, to refer people to a publication from our Royal College, which is the intergenerational cycle of speech, language and communication difficulties and the impact it has on life chances for people all the way around, and for us to ask ourselves, what are we doing to intervene early enough? And if you are looking for help and support in this area, speech and language therapy services are under the same pressure other services are. But we're here, we're all across Scotland, and most of us have got open referral systems. So lift the phone, give us a shout, and if we can help, we will.
Thank you very much. Very useful bit of insight. There was a question at the back, and then there's a question at the front. To the back first.
Hello, I'm Leslie MacDonald. I'm the clinical lead for Looked After Children's Health Services in Greater Glasgow and Clyde. And I had two comments for Jim, if that's okay. Firstly, we or my colleague here undertook an audit recently of the information we received at the time of referral for looked after and accommodated children. So we looked at all of our new referrals over a 4-month period and we received parental health forms for none of them. So it's very difficult for us to provide health advice on the impact of parental health if we don't receive that information in the first place. So my plea would be to social work colleagues to have those forms completed and submitted to us, and then we can give accurate health advice moving forward. Secondly, I completely agree that we need to standardise health assessments across the country, and we've done that to some extent with the Scottish Government Guidance publication in 2014, but also to say that we recently, well, a year ago or so now, submitted an application for an MCN proposal, which has stalled at the very early stages, but I've spoken with the staff again this morning and they've agreed to revisit that. So perhaps you could speak to them at lunch as well and add some fuel to that fire. That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that might be a useful outcome of today to move towards some standardisation. Did you want any reply to that?
No, it's a perfect answer to the question. It's exactly what we're looking for and what we're trying to do. What I have to be careful about is that all services are under tremendous pressure. Yeah. All services have not got the resources to complete the job that needs to be completed. And I recognise that. But if we work together, and especially with what was suggested, if we support each other's arguments, I'm more than happy to sit with the Royal College for Speech and Language or the Lackner side of things kind of thing and go up to government and have that argument with them. Yeah. And I think what we need to do is start to combine our arguments. I think each of us going up as individual professions and making an argument is not as effective as six professions sitting there saying, this is how it impacts on all of us.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are two issues here. There's the issue of what's the problem, and then there's the issue of what's the solution. I think we can perhaps address the first one more rapidly.
Do you think we should have a challenge to the government to have communal records across health boards so that you don't have to wait for the health board to release before you get the information you need?
I guess that would be the vision of standardisation, so yes. She's gone. Sorry, you've been waiting very patiently.
Thank you. I'm Alison McCollum. I work in Public Health and NHS Borders, and my question follows on really very neatly from what Jim has just said. I guess I was really impressed and interested in hearing about the different perspectives of those of you who've got lots of experience in working with different vulnerable groups. And I'm wondering how we can get better at using different specialisms, particularly in smaller boards or smaller areas where we've got using mainly very generalist skills. How can we use the best possible examples of using specialist knowledge where that might be increasingly more centralised in particular parts of Scotland to ensure that we're giving equally good care to our children wherever they are geographically?
And I guess that's a million-dollar question that everyone would want to duck. And I guess to a certain extent that follows on from the standardisation. Sorry, Una.
Just the Royal College of Paediatrics had a meeting some time ago about trying to improve coordination and sharing information. And it was then said that I think NSD was going to try to create a database of signposting to services, but we haven't seen the outcome of that. So again, it might be something from today to say if there's a general need being identified, that we go back to say, where are the signposts, please?
I think that's what one part of it. I suppose I'm interested in examples of good practice where we've got collaborative working to perhaps support the same families, but across a central resource and a more local, more regular support that might be available to a family. So databases and signposting, yes, but that's a recurrent theme in any discussion that you're in. It's always a challenge to do that.
For the governorship project, the big thing that we did was when we have our MDT meetings and social work colleagues come along, they bring their own laptop, we bring our own laptop, because the two systems between health and social care aren't joined up at the moment. And it'll probably take, if you're waiting for data systems to join up, I think we'll be waiting forever. I think what's really important about the discussions with complexity are the professionals and the shared information, the face-to-face discussions. And I think that's what we're trying to argue for in the Govern project, is that you need that face-to-face discussion. As soon as you fragment services around these complex families, information just gets lost. And it's really important that that's brought together, because the localised knowledge is just so important. So social work colleagues look at their database. We have a planned sort of list of who we're going to talk about. So they come forewarned before the meeting. with information that helps us in planning, and it's all about planning the complexity and how you deal with it. But I think the long-term relationships between professionals is extremely important.
Can I just maybe come in, just I touched on general and versus specialists in the debate that goes on around that, and there's probably something about urban and rural areas in terms of how we do things better for marginalised groups, both at mother end of the job is homelessness and asylum seekers and refugee healthcare is probably about the basic principles of inequality sensitive practice. And if we all really practice that and engage with individuals and develop their trust and relationships, then good person-centred care happens. But we need to invest in our workforce and give them the confidence to practice and the time to practice in that way. And at times then a specialist element isn't required because we have really good skills in some of the general workforce, and in the kind of more rural areas we don't always need to specialise things.
Jim Garnier.
This might be rather a sort of crude mechanism, but in reality, if you inspect on the issue, you get our bosses, our managers, all making that a priority. And I don't think the world should work like that. But if you go to the care inspectorate and you, for example, relating to what I said, if you actually say that we now want the care inspectorate to pick up all the health needs assessments and make sure they're fully completed, to make sure they're fully put in place, then it's a crude mechanism and it's not the world I want to live in, but it works and it's effective.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, one question from Richard, one there at the back, and then we'll close. But
this is for Anne Forsyth. It's often alleged that refugees and asylum seekers and migrants in general put a huge strain on the NHS, the health services in general. And I wondered to what extent this is true, whether how asylum seekers and refugees and migrants' health compares to the local population. The reason why I ask this is in the Black Report, which I mentioned earlier, they identified migrants in general as being self-selecting and in terms of fitness and health. And it's quite a good quote here. Men and women prepared to cross oceans and continents in order to seek new occupation opportunities or a new way of life do not represent a random cross-section of humanity. I just wondered how far that's true in your experience.
I could probably talk just much more about asylum seekers and refugees, and maybe Anne, just in the context of working in an area in Glasgow where it's got high immigration and migrant population. So in terms of strain on resources, that's not borne out in the facts about in terms of healthcare needs that we see. So we, in general, people coming through that process are fit, healthy and have good health behaviours. But most of them know how to use the system. It tends to be people who have come from kind of more affluent areas, have more resources and therefore will work towards understanding their rights and entitlement, of which I think we need to do better for other marginalised groups as well. So I think in terms of what we're challenged by at times is the language barrier, so communication has come up. In terms of use of interpreters takes longer, and the resources that's required to do that. So certainly I know a lot of health board areas it's language line telephone interpreters are very effective, but there's some areas as well that face-to-face is appropriate, but there is about a change in practice that everybody wants a face-to-face interpreter. That's not possible, so it's about thinking about how we use our resources. So sometimes it's not the individual people who are seeking our services that are choosing to use the resources in the way they do, it's us as healthcare practitioners. So we need to balance some of that stuff out and have real conversations about using our resources. But that's the main challenge that I hear coming from healthcare services is interpreting.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, Sally Egan, NHS Lothian. Just going back a wee bit to the LAC assessments. Jim, I see you somewhere, but not quite. I sort of took up the gauntlet after Jim with the LAC, and I was the vice chair of the review group that produced the healthcare guidance that you were speaking about. And we couldn't quite get 14 health boards to sign up to doing it the same, but hopefully with the guidance, they would make sure that when they were assessing and whatever services they used would be to that standard. And we have done self-evaluation since, but it is an issue. But just by way of a wee bit of reassurance, one of the things I'm pushing for as the lead board lead for our board for the new child health surveillance system is that within the due diligence exercise, we have said that we would really like to see a pre-formatted forum within the child health surveillance system that captures some of the key outputs so that we can at least have baseline data across Scotland and that there's one place where information can be held. But we know it's only as good as that initial assessment and the follow-up review. And one of the issues that boards are facing is capacity. So you can do the initial assessment, you can get various interventions to go in there and then, but who follows up? Because given the number of LAC nurses we have, they would end up with caseloads of 1,000 within 3 years. So we need to think that through, and there is work going on. But also the new universal school nursing pathway, there is an opportunity there to really try and standardise. So I would hope through some of the groups, Libby and I sit in a national group where we're looking at all the various nursing elements of children's services and where the commonality is across both the roles and the processes. And I think Marion Flynn sits in that group as well. So there's three of us that could maybe push for this to be maybe put back on the drawing board, as it were. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Just to say thanks, Sally, that it's really good to know that we're keeping on pushing, we're keeping the fight going. I think the only thing I'd add into that is the economic argument. A 20-minute session with a speech and language therapist is an awful lot cheaper than 8 years in care.
Okay. And if I can challenge you to put that on your list of stuff to do next week. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to bring the session to an end. That's been a really good session. I've got lots of notes, and I can read some of them. We are due to adjourn back here at 5 past. Can I make it 10 past? I don't plan to talk for 15 minutes when we get back. So a bit of housekeeping. Dinner is served through here in what is nicely called the new library. There is a presentation through in the Cullen Suite in the front that is Child Health Scotland's. There's a new DVD for kinship carers. Feel free to do what you tell your kids not to do, and that's to walk around with a plate of food, either from there through to here, or are we allowed to go through? I think we'll probably be allowed to go through to the Cullen Suite. So, there's food through there as well. So you can eat here and eat there. So, please, have a nice lunch, network, socialise, keep on thinking about what you're going to do when you get back to work on Monday, and have a good twit. Okay. Moves in the shape.